Welcome to the More Than Birds podcast, where we talk about more than birds. So today we're here with John Eichert, writer and adventure traveler, who has been extensively through Central Asia, the subcontinent. Where else?
59 countries altogether and counting. Central America, South America, a couple of spots in Africa, a little bit in Europe, but a lot in East Asia, all the little countries. I've been a lot of here, there, and everywhere. It's fun. About the biggest problem with trying to see the whole world in one lifetime is there's a lot of places that it's fun to go more than once.
Right.
And that slows you down.
And so how did you get into doing, this adventure travel?
When I was a little boy, every summer we took a 2-week vacation. And I liked it. So I just decided to make my life a 2-week vacation. And just keep going. Some of my fondest memories as a little boy were just, sitting in the back seat, staring out the window when we were tooling around on vacation, and there's just so much to see. And I just had this imagination and this curiosity and always want to see what's over that hill and what's beyond that lake and what happens at the end of the forest. And
so you were traveling all through growing up. And
yeah, I just enjoy it, I guess. And as I got older and started traveling internationally, one of my favorite feelings is when you've been gone for a long time, maybe a couple months, 3 months, and you come home. And you land in Missoula, and you're driving south, and you get over that little hump there by Lolo, and the Bitterroot spreads out to you. And that is one of the great feelings in the world. And you come home, and the cat jumps up on your lap, and the bed all of a sudden feels comfortable. And then you get up the next day, and you look around, and you see things different. After being gone, I've looked around at home and seen things that have been there for 20 years, and I'll see them for the first time. Mm-hmm. And that's pretty fun. So it makes home better for me.
Right, to travel. And so how many months out of the year are you gone typically?
Well, it depends. A lot of things, politics and economy, but anywhere from 6 weeks to the longest I've ever been gone is 7 months. 7 months is pretty cool.
Yeah. Long time away from home. And so when you go on these trips, are you usually intending to go somewhere new, or have you started to repeat because you like somewhere enough that it's starting to be a repeat?
Well, I always try and take something new in every time. I mean, there's a lot of places it's a real dense environment for things to see. A great example of that is Cusco in Peru. Well, you can't go any direction of Cusco, and there are just so many cool things, beyond Sacsayhuaman or Machu Picchu or Ollantaytambo to go see. There's just a lifetime of places that, that aren't the famous ones. So many of them are actually better ruins. Chopocalcui is a great example of that. So that's fun. Say Kathmandu, you can go in any direction from Kathmandu, and there is just a lifetime of things to see and do. So every time you go back, maybe, South America, you go to Cusco, and you're doing a trip to Machu Picchu and the train, and you repeat those things, but there's always opportunity for that little new thing that you know, let's go see this, you know, despite all the efforts to make tours run on time, inevitably a tour, you know, something happens, this plane doesn't fly, that bus doesn't run, this road gets washed out, something, and then you go in a new direction, and that really makes it fun. That's the adventure part.
And what you said, you know, you're in Peru, so is what percentage of your travel is Latin America, and what percentage is?
Well, first I did most of my trips were to South America, and then over time it became more Asia, and so now it's just one tour to Peru and Bolivia, mm-hmm. And that's pretty fun. But most of the stuff now is India and Nepal and Tibet. I'm really finding that I enjoy those places, and especially Tibet. Anybody that loves Montana and big, wide open spaces, Tibet and Mongolia will just blow you away. It's just huge.
Now, given you know, the communist government in China and the difficulty getting in Tibet as a Westerner, how do you work that system without...
You know, it's really hard, because, you know, you just have to be far more patient, because you can come and go one day and there's no problem, and somebody somewhere has an argument with somebody else, and all of a sudden it's the border crossings change. And because the border crossings between China and Nepal are very open and free-flowing, so that Nepalese and Chinese can come and go back and forth across the border, much the way, you know, you can with the United States and Canada, that if you just show documentation, you come and go. But if, you know, you are an American wanting to go to Tibet, you know, just as an example, the rules changed 5 times last year. So... It's just that patience thing, and probably the best news is the more that China embraces capitalism, the less likely they are to hold you for too long in a border crossing, especially, you know, if they check your documentation and see that you have, you know, a couple of credit cards and a pocket full of cash. They're like, welcome to our country, please spend freely. So.
Right.
And I've watched that change over the last 12 years.
So they become a lot more open and free-flowing?
Commerce-minded.
Now, you know, we've all seen pictures like the Potala in Lhasa, and it seems very Chinese manicured in that way they do. You know, they set up their little amusement parks. It's very, very Chinese. How do you get away from that?
Well, you know... Easily. How's that for it?
Yeah.
But, you know, there are, not just in China, but in many venues, there are significant sites that everyone wants to see. But once you get there, and especially if you've gone there more than once, they're a tad bit like Disneyland. Machu Picchu, the Louvre, the Potala. I mean, you just, you go a couple times and you're like, you know, this is an important treasure, but everybody's trying to get their commerce and attached to it. So, but fortunately, during the communist takeover, they didn't destroy all the monasteries. And I've been really fortunate to make friends over the years with a lot of local Tibetans, and with due exercise of caution, they'll take you to very remote sites that were not destroyed, mm-hmm. that because they were insignificant or too small or too this or too that, or it was just too far, or in one case, a small stupa that I've been to a number of times, the Chinese used it to store wheat.
Oh, really?
And so they left it intact to store wheat in it.
So it just became a silo.
It just became a silo, and then they abandoned it and left it. So the frescoes are a tad bit roughed up, you know, from the wheat coming and going, but they're still there, and there's no bullet holes, and all the walls are there. So it's – and there are a lot of those little places. And you get – and it's interesting in that – now as the commerce flows, as there's more tourists, I think I want to, you know, I think now there's something like over 200,000 foreign tourists visit Tibet in a year, and with that commerce you get a money flow. Well, and that we've always been meaning to build that wall over there alongside the monastery, and before you know it. In a short period of time, the structure itself changes. A classic example is in Peru, at Machu Picchu in Cusco. For whatever reason, the local people have decided to start to rebuild some of the old buildings. Mm-hmm. Not an exact replica of what would have been there, but just to try and fill it in to make it look nice.
Right.
You know, and I've seen there's a monastery below the north face of Everest called Rongpu. Or Rongbuk, or
right.
You know, when you
I just saw that monastery in Blindsight, the BBC.
Oh, really?
To blind Tibetan kids, and did one of the side mountains up Everest, like 23,000 feet. Five or six blind kids.
Lhokpa Rhee, yeah, and it has morphed through the years. That as more people go there, there are more donations are left. At the monastery, mm-hmm. It grows richer, and now that wall that had not been changed in 100 years is now rebuilt, and there's new walls and new courtyard.
It looks nice.
It looks nice, and you're like, so, you know, I think a historian or an archaeologist might be a little disappointed because a lot of the ancient antiquity type treasures. You have to go and look for the little out-of-the-way places.
Right.
Because my favorite phrase is, you know, a lot of the – any site that's on, like, somebody's top 20 places to go thing, it's Disneyland.
Right.
You know, it is – the Louvre is a fascinating experience, but it's Disneyland.
Right. You only need to go once.
You know, and you're just like, wow. And Machu Picchu is a fascinating place, and to watch the sun come up there in the morning is truly spectacular, but it is a carnival. I mean, there's so much myth now that surrounds Machu Picchu that you just, it's funny to listen to what people say. And you're like, where in the world? And every time you go back, you hear like, whoa, I have never heard that. Where did you get that? You know, and like, well, it was on the internet.
Well, it has to be true.
It was on the internet.
And when when you're visiting like these monasteries and they're rebuilding the monasteries, is that kind of an indication that the Chinese government is relaxed religious freedoms a little bit? They're allowing the monasteries to rebuild, and
they have. And you know, I think you know, it is what it is. And I can't imagine what it would be like to live in a country that's being occupied by a foreign power. You know, I think that would be difficult. But conversely, I've seen a lot more trees in Tibet, around Lhasa especially, and down past Gongsha, the airport, and down the Tsangpo River and around Samye. They put in a huge tree planting project everywhere, and I like to see that.
So were all the trees cut down like for firewood initially?
Yeah. And you know, and that was, you know, and then nobody ever got around to planting any or putting any back. So those are good things, but you know, you right in Lhasa at the Jokhang, you have which is a very significant site for Tibetan Buddhists. It is a pilgrimage site. But again, it has become the Disneyland thing. you have one entrance to the Jokong for the tourists and another one around back for the pilgrims. And, you know, they actively try and keep the tourists with the tourists, but not like with sticks and batons and hurting you, but they just, you know, there will be different guys standing in the square in front of the Jokong, and as you try and walk, you know, there's definitely, you feel like you're being funneled to
particular spots,
to a particular spot, and that's, and then, you know, the big square didn't used to be. It used to be a bunch of buildings and homes in front of the Jokong. Well, the Chinese flattened that all out and created a big square, so there's more room to move, and you can see. And I suppose, you know, yes, I suppose you could get a tank in there if you had to easily. But so the whole structure itself of that community or that neighborhood within Lhasa changed. And now you have all the little attending restaurants, you know, and what you would call, you know, the Chinese version of chain restaurants. There'll be like four or five same, you know,
So is most of the commerce Chinese and Han Chinese versus Tibetan?
Oh, yeah, definitely. In most of the people you see in Lhasa are Han Chinese.
And do the Tibetans, you know, we know that, you know, the Tibetan community in exile, and you wouldn't call it animosity, but they want their country back.
Well,
are the Tibetans, do you hear that or sense that from them? Do they have some sort of animosity towards the Han Chinese?
You know, and I don't speak for the Tibetan people
right.
or the Chinese government. I just my own observations, and I think what I found is it's divided. You have some Tibetans who live in India or Nepal have accepted the fact that Tibet is Chinese, and you know they've become expatriates and now have Indian or Nepalese mm-hmm. tourist visas, and because there's that flow. You know, some of them go back and forth quite frequently. And then you have the same that some people that, you know, there's a lot of animosity and they still feel angered. And you know, as a Montanan, I've been on the different Indian reservations here. And you still, the anger there is palpable. So, you know, there are worldwide communal feelings that people share about their histories, and you know the people of Tibet are no different. It becomes a little more homogenous every year.
Yeah, but, a little more Han Chinese homogenous, you mean?
More, yeah, because they just. More and more people seem to accept that this is just the way it is. And I'm not saying good or bad either way.
Right.
But I think as a tourist, and I've pointed this out to other travelers that I've met in Tibet, and I'll say, well, you realize, of course, that the person that's your guide, your local guide, is not Tibetan. And they'll quickly turn and go, well, he told me he is Tibetan. Well, sure, he lives in... You know, I'm not a linguistics expert, but, you know, the guy looks Han Chinese,
right.
not Tibetan. You know, look at that person over there. That person is a Tibetan. Look at that person over there. That person is Chinese. Right. Now, if you live in Lhasa, well, then you're Tibetan, and I can appreciate the humor of that. But it's just it fascinates me that no matter where you go, whether it's the Louvre or Machu Picchu, people, especially the first time they're there, they get this oh my God thing right. going on, and it's fascinating.
It's like going to Disney World and saying the castle's really small. Oh, people will want to kill you.
They will. Yeah. Yeah.
It's not that great.
Yeah. Woo.
So
that's a good. Yeah, you're right.
It's true. The tourists who come, that's what they spent years saving for. That's what they want to see, and when they don't see it, they make it bigger in their mind.
Yeah.
You know, they make the experience in their mind. And so when you take these trips, you know, you're saying about going into Tibet. You've also recently been to Pakistan.
Yeah.
So where in Pakistan and why?
You know, the why part, there are questions that have no answers, other than perhaps I've always I have a long enduring love of big mountains, and some of the biggest ones in the world are in Pakistan, and I love remote wild country, and some of the most remote and wild places left on Earth are in Pakistan. As a matter of fact, an organization in the province that I went to, the government of Pakistan had asked them several years ago if they wanted a road built in to a remote village. And they said, well, no. And if you, you know, that would be like, you know, we should build a road to Derby. And the people of Derby would say, well, no. Let's have the road stop at Hamilton, and anybody wants to come to Derby can walk.
What was their reasoning for not wanting the road?
They wanted to be remote.
They didn't want outside influence. And
I went into a little village called Sadapara in northern Pakistan, and I wanted to meet a man that was a bit of a legend in as far as mountaineering. He was the only high altitude porter on the first ascent of K2. He's still alive, and he's in his mid-80s, and he lives in the village of Sadapara. And so I walked into this village, you know, to try and find this man. I wanted to meet him, and I did. And he invited me into his house, and we had tea. And as we were just getting to know each other, he put his hand on, and he had these great expressive eyes. And he's just a really wonderful gentleman. He put his hand on my leg and tapped it and laughed. And he goes, you're an American. I said, yeah, I'm an American. He said, I want you to know that my village has no oil. I still think that's one of the funniest things. In other words, we have nothing that the outside world wants. Thank you very much. Here's some tea.
Right.
And there, so that, but I ran into that. That demeanor, that mindset, often in northern Pakistan. It's like, you know, some of the places in Pakistan are having a lot of trouble, you know, provinces with
Waziristan
and around Peshawar and Khyber Pass and places that butt up against Afghanistan. And then in the northern province where I was, you know, there's a lot of pressure from China along the Karakoram Highway to... So everybody's trying to get them to change. And you have these people who have lived the same way, like the gentleman, and I ended up staying at his house. It was a great, great time. You know, his family had always, as far as lived in the same place, in the same village, and they have grown wheat and apricots for hundreds and hundreds of years. Mm-hmm. And I met his oldest son, who was actually older than I am.
Oh, and so this guy's really old.
Yeah, he was. Thanks a lot, Rad. And his son said, "You know, this is what I want for my grandchildren. This is what we want. It's a very simple life. We like this. You know, we have been to." You know, the big cities and the bright lights and TVs and no thanks.
Right. And how this province, you call it a northern province. So I'm imagining a sandwich between like Waziristan and Kashmir kind of, or.
Yeah, it is, you know, the Gilgit is the main city. And it's just great big mountains and valleys and unlike here where you know our mountains aren't so big, but there because the walls of the mountains are so steep that most of the snow stays up high and so the valleys tend to be very low. The place that I stayed, Sadapara, they grow apricots.
Right.
And I know there's only a few places in Montana where you can
grow apricots.
So that's how mild the climate is. Plus, they've got the biggest honking sheep that I've ever seen. I sat in my tent one evening and I had some you know, small portable binoculars with me, and I was watching some sheep. They were maybe 3-4 miles away, and they were just enormous. There, the ram that was in that was it was just huge. Marco Polo sheep.
Marco Polo sheep. Yeah.
And just, you're just like, my goodness, his head, you know, with the horns, would be like the size of a bull buffalo. Mm-hmm. You just, you know, that thing must, what probably would have weighed 450, 500 pounds.
It's huge.
It was huge. It was you know, it was like a pony. Yeah.
And how much wildlife do you see somewhere in PAC? You know, in this, is there a lot of wildlife?
Saw a lot of wildlife in Pakistan. Saw ibex and sheep. Sheep everywhere. And according to the guy who was the local guide, he said since Pakistan has developed these trade relations with China, that it's been really good for the wildlife because the Russians used to come and hunt sheep and brown bear with the helicopters.
Oh, Jesus.
And so now that has all stopped, there's a lot of them. And you know, so I didn't see a brown bear there, but I saw there was tracks in one valley one morning, and I saw some cat tracks, which I would assume are snow leopards. Mm-hmm. At that altitude, it couldn't have been anything else.
Yeah.
And indeed, I heard from a friend of mine in northern who lives in Nepal, who said that, you know, with the success of so many border projects and so many things have changed that the snow leopards in Nepal are beginning to become a little bit of a nuisance. So it's like, you know, again, it's that good thing. And who's unhappy now? Well, it's the local guy whose goats just got carried away in the night.
Right.
So it's always a give and take. But it's just so, you know, there's and they're near well, where I went to a national park, and it was called Deosai National Park, and there's a large international brown bear research station there, and it's gorgeous. It looks like the Beartooth Plateau in Montana.
It's high altitude, no trees.
No trees, just gorgeous, like a high. And I took a bunch of pictures of the Deosai, and then I had some fun with some friends. I said, Beartooth, Deosai,
and
it looks exactly the same. Oh, wow. And you couldn't pick out the differences. You know, they're just, it's fun to go see places
so
like that.
This region of Pakistan that you went was fairly stable, or?
Really stable. The Gilgit-Baltistan region is heavily controlled. Mm-hmm. And there's an airport there. It's Gardu, and everything is really tightly controlled. It is the main tourist venue in Pakistan, and they want to keep it that way.
So did you venture into Kashmir and travel east?
Or? No, didn't. Not this time.
Have you been?
Yeah, I've been to Srinagar and Dal Lake, and that's fantastic. As a matter of fact, it's interesting you ask. A friend of mine, Bilal, just opened a new hotel. This is not a advertisement, but it sounds like it. A new hotel in Dal Lake. He sent me the pictures, and he's just like, it makes you want to go. Right. You know, it's a huge mountain lake like Flathead Lake. Only there's, you know, because of the really unique environment there, you know, there's lotus that grow, and it's,
oh really?
Yeah.
So I was thinking Kashmir. Actually, I just think of it as a high altitude goat pasture. Like, what are they fighting over? You know, I never understood that. Is it just bragging rights? Is it just
I think
rights?
It's men.
Yeah.
You know, a Pakistani guy decided he didn't want part of his whatever it was, and so he gave it to India, and India said, we'll take it. Well, then, you know, people in Pakistan after a while said, well, we didn't really – it wasn't his to give away. And then most of the people who live there, you know, align themselves with Pakistan, not India, you know, But you have India, who has a theoretically legal claim to it. Mm-hmm. So you, and anybody, anytime anybody needs to flex a little muscle, then they just do. And, you know, any country that has a great big army, you know, the army itself, you know, it, if things are too quiet for too long, you know, they got to make something happen, because they're
right. How can they justify their existence?
How can they justify taking all that money? Yeah. So when you have two huge armies living next door to each other in India and Pakistan, you know, when somebody, they both kind of hope somebody else will start something so that they have a reason to have those big armies. You know, it's like last year there was the thing on TV, Hatfields and McCoys. Well, you know, you got the same kind of play going on between, you know, Pakistan and India in Kashmir. Just, you know, I think they've been fighting for so long, nobody's really sure why they hate each other.
Right. So when you travel to Pakistan, you have to think that, you know, things are going to get hairy sooner or later. So, I mean, do you run into situations that are a tad difficult or need some serious massaging, maybe with, you know, a few bills?
Well, you know, I'd been to Pakistan once before in the 80s. So, you know, I had a feel for what I was getting into. And so, and plus I just – and some of the people that I had met that I had – when I was there the first time, I still knew him. So I've had really old, dear friends now that have lived there. So and then I was kept asking, you know, what do you think? And they said, well, no, it's no problem. And, you know, there was no reason for them not to say, you know, if they were going to, if I shouldn't go, they would have said something.
Right.
And so I went, and everywhere I went, people were friendly and wonderful and warm. And especially, I loved the look you'd get when you would say, "Well, no, I'm not Canadian, or I'm not New Zealand. I'm American," and they would just do the double take look, and they're like, "Whoa!" But I think news has to try and make news. News is like a big army. If it doesn't create conflict, it's not being good news. Nobody will pay attention, and Pakistan is not the boogeyman that I thought it might be. I mean, I knew my friends wouldn't lead me wrong, but still there was that niggling thing in the back of the mind.
Right.
And so the third day I was there, my friends took me out to dinner at this place called the Montana.
Oh, jeez.
It's this really nice restaurant way up in the hills above Islamabad, so it's a little cooler. And it has a great view of the mountains and the whole city. And we went up there and we got there just as the sun set. And it was during Ramadan. So it was very important. People had been fasting all day.
So they're going to the restaurant once the sun's down. They're hungry.
So the place was packed. And this big full moon came up. And here I was, you know, the only Westerner in a restaurant with probably 300 people from Islamabad, and nobody even gave me the time of day.
Right.
Nobody even, and I thought, and that was so reassuring. I mean, there was no whispering or hushed or, you know, hands to the side of the mouth, and it was just, nobody even, you know, I went through it was kind of a smorgasbord type of, you know, or a buffet style, and I just went down through and you know, English is the first language of Pakistan. So you'd like, what is this? And, well, this is a spicy kebab. This is a lamb kebab. This is, you know, and God, the food was tremendous.
Yeah.
It was really good. So, you know, and so that was the end of being worried. I mean, and that just, that set the tone. And everywhere I went, people were just as cordial and friendly, and they would be really honest. And they're like, well, I'd say, well, could we go here? And they go, well, maybe only during the day. Or could we go there? And they would go, maybe not. And you go, right. Can we go here? And they go, oh yeah, no problem.
So they're in tuned enough that they know where it's safe and where it's not safe.
Yeah. So it was just really fun. It was, it was fun. And God, the mountains in Pakistan are just spectacular.
So you said you know you've been to 59 countries. You know, what was the most unique, you know, whether it was more backwards or just crazy of a country that you've been to?
See, I would define that as the country that was most like the country that I thought I was going to go to see.
Right.
So it was the country that had so remained that country that it just it, and that was Ireland.
Really?
Ireland is Ireland. I mean, Dublin is a little international, mm-hmm. but you quickly get out of town and you're in Ireland. You know, and a lot in international travel, you run into people that say, "Well, I want to see the real, you know, I want to see the real Peru, or I want to see the real India, or I want to see the real Nepal."
Right.
Well, in a lot of cases, those things just don't even exist anymore.
Right.
I mean, you can go to some, especially in peninsular India, you can go to some towns that are absolutely certainly the real India, or out in the West. Jaipur and the Thar Desert, that is definitely the real India. But India is so populated.
Right.
And everybody, it's like America, everybody's got a cell phone and a laptop, and everybody is universal. But you go to little villages in Ireland, and there are places that, you know, there's like one line of electricity running in, and they got like two light bulbs in the room, and it's just like, wow.
So
it's Ireland.
It still has the feel of, that's interesting.
You know,
I wouldn't have thought it would be Ireland.
It has astonished me. Some good friends from Stephensville, John and Lorraine Conlon, go all the time, and to talk to them and watch John's slideshows, you're like, yeah. You know, people go around on bicycles.
Right.
You know, and you're like, think about that. You know.
So they're never more than 10 miles from home.
Yeah. And it's just like it is. And so you have these uncluttered landscapes. And it's wonderful. You know, and so the pace of life is different. And you know, so many places that have been, the country that is... It is so much like you would have had imagined it was 100 years ago, is Ireland. And I see that as very positive. I'm not saying they're backward or you know, or regressive or anything like that. It's just they have a strong national sense of identity, and they have not allowed the modern world to run roughshod over that. I respect that, admire that. I love Ireland. I love Irish people. They're really cool.
I wouldn't have thought that. I wouldn't.
Yeah.
So, you know, we're kind of getting back to Asia in my mind, but where else have you been in Central Asia?
Well, just Pakistan and peninsular India.
Mm-hmm.
Years ago, I tried when I was in Pakistan to get into Afghanistan, but the Khyber Pass was closed at that time, so I didn't get to do that. Which, you know, maybe years now, maybe never want to do that. But,
right.
But, well, who knows? You know, stuff is changing.
It wasn't in the 60s that a lot of Europeans went to Afghanistan for hiking.
Oh, yeah.
It was like a popular thing to do.
Oh, yeah. And in the old, you know, Soviet Union, like in the Pamirs, which is now like Kazakhstan, I think, mm-hmm. you know, great, great trekking. I mean, there's great places to go trekking that people have never heard of, because you hear of Nepal and Peru, and then it kind of stops there.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, I haven't had the pleasure in Afghanistan, but I understand it, there's just some tremendous wonks. The same thing in Western Mongolia, Northern China, you know, Tajikistan, Kazakhstan, You know, there's a lot of places, and I think one of the
so have you been to Mongolia?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, Mongolia looks like Montana. Mm-hmm. It's really scary. It really does.
It looks like the Lewistown area. When I see pictures, it looks like Lewistown. You know, those rolling hills, scattered pines.
Do you know where Grass Range is?
Yeah.
It looks like you could be like you go around a corner, you expect to pull into Grass Range.
Right. It's just the exact same look. Yeah.
It just has that same look to it. So it's just really pretty, and the people are real friendly. And I made a massive mistake to let them know that, you know, I was from Montana and I didn't know how to ride a horse, because those guys can ride.
Right.
Ooh, dogs. You know, and so all their horses were used to a much better rider than I was. And so good news is they aren't big horses, so the fall wasn't far.
Right. There's a little tiny
compact horse. And they're just quicker. God, I can't imagine what it would be like to cut cattle, you know, on a horse that is that quick and that small. I mean, it was really impressive how fast they were.
But they're literally born on a horse.
You know, the all those horses, though they're not used for warfare. Those were the you know the Great Khan. That's
right.
Where you know they needed a agile, small horse, small so that it's difficult to kill with an arrow, and agile because it's quick and in and out in battle and. You know, you're like, and they are. They're just like, it would be like riding a cat. They just seem like they could square corners.
You know, I was talking to Kunjug Norbu in a previous episode, and he spent, I think it was like 3 years in Mongolia.
Wow.
Helping rebuild a monastery. And he was saying, you know, about the Mongolians' hospitality. You know, they're in the middle of nowhere, and all of a sudden there's this, I think the Mongolians call it a gar instead of a yurt.
Mm-hmm.
But here's this, you know, this family's temporary home. And they stop in and, they start feeding them. And they insist they stay there for the night. And did you have the same experience?
They're just everywhere, you know. And, you know, there's always when you're traveling the joke about you stop and ask somebody for direction. And a lot of places the person will give you directions to some place, and they've never been there, but they're just trying to be helpful. Well, in Mongolia, they go, well, I tell you what, I'll take you there, but, you know, let the wife feed you first. You know, so after, you know, she stopped everything, cooked for 2 hours, you eat for 2 hours, then he goes, oh, yeah, come on now, I'll take you. So instead of just giving the instructions, they'll take you.
They'll take you there.
You know, and the guy will, you know, and you maybe only were off by 10 miles, and then he'll ride with you in the car, and he'll go, well, I'm going home now. And you're like, do you want to ride? Well, no, I'll walk.
It's not that far. Yeah.
It's not that far. And you're like, oh, my goodness, you know. But, you know, you different cultures, you're used to different things. And, it makes you wonder if you had to, and despite whether you physically could or not, would you walk at night, say, from Florence to Stevensville on the bike path? You
know? Right, 6 miles. No.
You know, would you? Yeah, exactly. You're just like, whereas, you know, this guy, what's going to be out in the woods where he's going to walk? Well, some brown bears, some wolves, you know. You know.
Just no big deal.
So, I don't know. I love that cavalier attitude of wild places, you know.
You know, we're talking about all these places, and you know, we talked, you know, about, you know, how India's crowded. And not too, you know, where's been the biggest circus you've seen? I mean, just not even a circus in terms of tourists, but in terms of just a mass of humanity.
I went and saw or listened to His Holiness the Dalai Lama in Calcutta, and the local paper said that there was 1.5 million people there, and it was extraordinary. It really was. I'd never, you know, I'd been to a soccer game in Brazil, and the stadium held 110,000 people, and you're like, and that was a lot. I mean, you just look around, and it kind of took your breath away how many people were there. And then to just be in this mass of people, you know, and it was scary for quite a while. So I thought, if if something happened and everybody started like stampeding, you'd be doomed.
Right.
You know, so it was, but you know, everybody was there to hear about the Dharma, and it came off really well, and it was astonishing. You know.
So how many times you've been to India, either as a the site of the tour of a jumping off point for a tour?
7 times. So I even been there, went and got a hip there.
Got a hip.
Yeah.
Cheaper.
It was less than I would have spent even with insurance in the United States. Plus the guy was actually one of the 5 best orthopedic surgeons in the world. He just happened to be from Chennai. He had his medical degree from Oxford, and he was an intern in Birmingham with the doctor who invented prosthesis replacement surgery.
So he knew what he was doing.
So yeah, this he you know, the guy has 30 years of experience in with at that time 4,500 procedures, and in that time there had never been a failure, and only one person had ever developed an infection. Mm-hmm. You're like, that's better than any hospital in America.
Right.
So. You know.
And plus, you get a trip to India out of the deal.
Well, you know, you could, you know, you need some surgery, and you could lay in a hospital in America and eat American hospital food, or down there they took me in a private car to a oceanside beach resort, and instead of laying in a hospital bed, I laid in a hammock and listened to the Indian Ocean come up and down on the beach, and it was like. Yeah, this works. This is good. Yeah. So it was pretty easy to convalesce that way.
And so the other trips you've taken, I mean, where do you like to go in India?
You know, it's everybody that goes to India needs to go to Agra so that you can see the Taj Mahal. Right. You don't need to go see the Taj Mahal a second time because that's Disneyland. That's just like, you know, people are trying to sell you marble and you know, this is a diamond from the lost diamond mine of, you know, and you're just like, oh my God, you know, and it's just, and it doesn't stop, and everybody's trying to pick your pocket, and it's 104 degrees, and it's like, okay, this was fun, you know, now I've had enough.
Right, I never need to relive this.
Don't need to, but the places that I enjoy, down in Peninsular India, on the west side, like. Around Goa, where the beautiful beaches are, and you can go out into the mountains there, the Western Ghats, and that's an incredible place. You know, Dharamsala in North, Manali, Leh, Dras, the Zanskar River, those are just spectacular mountain scenes, and you know, there's big mountains there, Nanda Devi, and well, not near Leh, it's east of there, at the mouth of at the headwaters of the Ganges, and you know, those are pretty, and but one of the cool places, and again, I'm a mountain junkie, is outside of Darjeeling, there's a place called Tiger Hill, and you can either walk there or get a person in a jeep to take you up the top of Tiger Hill. And what's unique is you get there before sunrise, and northwest of where you stand is Kanchenjunga, which is the third highest peak in the world. And because I'm not a geographer, so I'm not exactly sure why that is, but Kanchenjunga gets the first light on the Himalayas, even though it's not the furthest east peak in the Himalayas, just the highest. And so it gets, you know, it's higher than the next highest peak by about 8,000 feet.
In front of it. To the east.
So to the east. So it gets the first light. And to be in a crowd of 4,000 people, and people are playing drums and pipes, and people are doing dances, and it is quite the experience. And then, you know, that rosy color hits the very top of Kanchenjunga, and it just, you can hear a pin drop. And then the little more sun comes and the mountain lights up and everybody starts chanting and it's pretty cool.
Are these mostly Hindi folks?
I would say yeah, probably some Hindi, Krishna.
What's the significance? Just that it's the first peak with light,
and right? And Kanchenjunga is a very holy peak to the people of Darjeeling and Siliguri and that whole area. It's pretty cool. Those little things that you never you don't necessarily go to look for, and they just show up. That's pretty cool.
So besides being a traveler, you're also a writer.
Yeah.
And I wanted you to talk a little bit about, your writing. How does your writing tie in with your travel, or does it tie in with the travel?
Well, it does, because I tried writing for newspapers and magazines, and there's so much competition for travel writing, and the more I wrote travel articles for myself, the more that I would enjoy them, the more editors would go, I don't want that. I want them just like this. But everybody else writes them just like that. So I kind of drifted away from that, but I still, I've always been, one of my favorite parts of when I was a little kid was listening to the old guys talk, and listening to all those stories. So I got the bug for storytelling about the same time that I got the bug for travel. And I was real fortunate. I cowboyed a little bit in the Upper Beaverhead for a while. And I got to know some older guys that cowboyed their whole life. And I mean, not on an ATV or in a truck, on a horse. And you'd sit around in the evenings, and I just was fascinated by all the stories that these guys would tell. And you just wondered how much it was true and how much it wasn't. And then I asked this one guy, an older guy, his name was O.D. Cleaver. And O.D. said, well, unless you were there, every other story you tell is fiction anyway. I thought, exactly. So I've kind of created a cluster of novels that is, I call it travel-inspired fiction. And that the foundation are places that I've been that I've really enjoyed. And I use, local legends and lore to enrich the stories. And it's worked really well. I'm beginning to have a little bit of a following with my writing, and I like that. And it was really fun because, when you progress in from, say, being a climbing instructor or a rafting guide, and you start doing longer trips where you're taking, you're working on a rafting trip that's 5 or 6 days, or you're taking some people trekking or leading a climb, you have a lot of downtime, a lot of quiet time. If you're waiting for buses or trains or planes or what have you, you have downtime, and so it's handy to be able to do some storytelling. And I had some people who were clients and then became my friends who just for years had insisted that I needed to write. And I said, well, I've tried this whole travel writing thing, but nobody's going to ever let anybody write like that. And the only person, I can't think of his name, the guy from Bozeman that wrote for Outside that did some F.
Dave Qualman?
No.
He's more of a science writer.
Yeah. Jaguars Ripped My Flesh was one of his books, and The Wolverines Ate My Toes. And anyway.
I know who you're talking about.
Yeah. I'm gridlocked for a second there. But, and he got away with writing a lot of that, but because he had written for a magazine for 15 years leading up to that. And it's like, well, nobody else is going to, I can't get into it. And then the lady said, well, then just write it as fiction. And she trumped that. She gave me a computer. So it was kind of like, well, now I guess I better. Right. So I sat down and there is a lot to learn about writing fiction. It took a long time, took a lot of classes, went to a lot of workshops, got a lot of work rejected, and it just kind of it made me want to do it more. And it's worked. And the piece that I'm finishing literally almost within the next couple of days, I'll have the draft completed, is about my character that is going to have to go around the world is, of course, is a budding secret agent, which, you know, and of course, as anybody who believes in secret agents, you know, they have to travel. So the story goes from Bangkok in Thailand to Indonesia and to the Canary Islands and Greece and Athens and Algeria and a little stop in Washington and all the Civil War battlefields. And so, you know, it's kind of fun to sit down and think of the places you've really enjoyed and then just use them as a setting. And I love – and it pays off because when somebody reads your work and they go, gosh, I felt like I'd been there. And it's, you're like, well, you know.
That was the idea.
That was the idea is, you know, write about what you know and make it fun. And that's fun.
So what are the titles?
Well, the first one I wrote, and I wrote it poorly because you got to start somewhere. And it's been waiting for me to rewrite it. It was called Dalagiri. And Dalagiri, in Sanskrit, Nepali, and Hindi, means the white mountain. But in Tibetan, the Tibetans who see Dalagiri from a different point of view, they call Dalagiri the rock that stands alone. So I just thought that was a wonderful literary take to it. And so I developed a story about a young man from Rainbow, Montana, who wanted to be a mountain climber, and he finds himself at Dalagiri. After that, I wrote a story about Patagonia, and it's called The Colony. And then I wrote, after a birthday party with my wife, I took her to the Prince of Wales Hotel in Waterton, Alberta, and we were sitting there after dinner in the bar, and the bartender regaled us with a story of Sarah, the ghost at the Hotel Prince of Wales. And we were sitting there, and my wife turned to me, and she goes, this would be a great Agatha Christie-style whodunit. And so Death at the Prince of Wales is available.
Death at the Prince of Wales.
Death at the Prince of Wales. After that came Dominion, which I set in Africa, which continues to amaze me and mystify me. Africa just feels so old when you're to me, mm-hmm. when I'm there, and the fact that there's still so much wildlife, and there's just so many different clans and tribes and cultures, and it's fascinating. And so then I finished Dominion, and people really liked it. As a matter of fact, one of the people that ended up reading it was at the time, but I guess he's moved on to a different job. But the gentleman was working as a reporter for the Kansas City Star, and he, through some in-laws who live in Missouri, came to read it, and he compared it to Heart of Darkness by Joseph Conrad. So I took that as a great sign that my writing is getting better all the time.
And how can you get Dominion?
The Amazon.com. It's only available now as an ebook. Recently got deals to get Dominion and Death and the Prince of Wales as a paperback, hopefully by fall. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that'll make it easier for people to get that. And I'm almost done with No Less Than Life, which is the spy novel. Then I'm going to go back and spruce up Dalagiri and The Colony. And so by Christmas time, I'll have 5 books in print.
Oh, great. And if people want to take a trip with you, how would they contact you?
You know, it's pretty simple. you can just send me an email. You can Skype me, the Twitter me, blog me. But my email is adventure@numbum.net. And so that address is numbum.net. And I got to tell you the story about that because it's so cute.
Okay.
12 years ago, coming down from a six-day trip on the Colca River in Peru, and had a group of English doctors, and this small lady who didn't swim and was on a class four rapid for all this time. She was a wonderful lady, very brave. And the last day, she came over the very last morning, and she came over and she tugged on my shirt in the morning, and she said, Johnny, today is the last day. And I'm like, yeah, Clara, today is the last day. And she goes, you know, I don't mean to sound wrong, but I'm terribly glad that today is the last day. And I go, oh, Claire, why? Is there something wrong? And she goes, no, I've got a terribly numb bum. I thought, so I changed the name of the company from Mountains Expeditions and Adventures to Numb Bum Adventures. Because you know what? That little lady from London was right. Wherever you go on any adventure, you get a numb bum. Because you sit waiting for your plane, you sit on an airplane, then you're in a taxi, a bus, a train, you're on a camel, a mule, an elephant, your butt's going to get tired.
Right.
Right. It just makes so much sense.
Well, thanks a lot, John.
Thanks, Red.
Thank you once again to John for that wonderful interview about his travels around the world. In this episode, we're going to review from Princeton University Press, Birds of India, Pakistan, Nepal, Bangladesh, Bhutan, Sri Lanka, and the Maldives, a wonderful field guide for the subcontinent. I have often dreamt of leaning against a giant rhododendron on some isolated hillside in the Kingdom of Bhutan, while rufous-necked hornbills and beautiful nuthatches appeared within the orbital sphere of my binocular vision. The entire Indian subcontinent is filled with a host of both familiar avian shapes and those that seem foreign to this new world-centric birding mind. Culturally, India is an entire break from my familiar Western mental confines. The streets of Varanasi crowded with sadhus, the banks of the Ganges lined with the smells, sights, and noises of the funeral pyres. The cycle of life and death so at hand. I live within a culture that desperately keeps all these concepts at arm's length, something we barely acknowledge. Within this chaos, a wonderful diversity of birds exists. And the comprehensive Birds of India, Pakistan, Nepal, Bangladesh, Bhutan, Sri Lanka, and the Maldives from Princeton University Press is the best field guide for the subcontinent. This guide is packed with an incomprehensible number of species accounts, some 1,375 in total, which are placed on the left page with the accompanying range maps for the species. The species illustrations are placed parallel on the right page. The quality of illustrations is generally great. However, several, not many, tend to be a little cartoonish. The range maps are generally of good quality. However, their limited size, they're about 1 inch by 1 inch, can make complicated distributions a bit difficult to comprehend. Given the immensity of the subcontinent, I cannot commend Grimmett and the Innskeeps, the authors of this field guide, enough for this colossal effort. It is rather difficult for me to wrap my mind around how many field and research hours the trio must have spent in compiling this wonderful field guide. My dreams of traveling through the streets of Varanasi and sitting under that Bhutanese rhododendron are firmly planted within my birding imagination. And who knows, maybe someday, soon, my Himalayan dreams will become my Himalayan reality. Birding within the footsteps of the Buddha. Thank you for listening to the More Than Birds podcast. And remember, visit us at radleyice.com, RadleyIce.com, or on Facebook at More Than Birds. Until next time, I hope you're out birding.